With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Welcome to On the Rise, a podcast about female college tennis players on the way up. On the Rise serves compelling stories and unique voices in women's college tennis. This is your host, Perry Scheinen. In this episode of On the Rise, I will be speaking with Wisconsin tennis alum Hannah Berner, who played number one singles and doubles for the Badgers before launching her comedy career. Now, Berner has over 2 million followers on TikTok, was a reality TV star on Summer House, and is currently on tour throughout North America. Welcome to another episode of On the Rise podcast. This is your host, Perry Scheinen, and I'm joined by Wisconsin women's tennis grad of 2013, Hannah Berner, who is now more than made it as a comedian in the entertainment world.
Thank you for having me. This is so awesome that you're doing this pod and to give a voice to, you know, the tennis world and the tennis transition. I always wanted to be a professional tennis player since I was like 7 years old. My parents asked a coach, like, our daughter decided yesterday she wants to be a professional tennis player. She wants to be Serena Williams. And they were like, ooh, she's starting too late. They told me that. Apparently I cried all day. I don't know what deep, intense drive I had as a seven-year-old. I should have been finger painting, but I was like, I need to be a professional tennis player. So I played on the tour a little when I was 16. I decided to go to college. It was up until my senior year. I did get hit by a car and I took it as a sign. I also lost like 5 matches in 10-point tie breaks. And I was like, the universe is telling me something and I have to listen to it.
Wow. You got hit by a car?
So it was in University of Wisconsin, go Badgers. Women's tennis had the worst weight schedule. Like, men's basketball would roll in at like 9 a.m. with a smoothie, where I was like 7 a.m., 6:30 a.m. going to the gym. So I was walking. It was like freezing. I think it was snowing, walking to weights. And I was like halfway across the road and I just got hit by a car. And I guess I wouldn't look both ways. That car definitely did not think there'd be a person walking around at 5:30 a.m. in 0-degree weather, but that's called being a college athlete.
Especially in Wisconsin when it's freezing.
Yeah, like the liquid in your eyes would freeze. My brother was there, not as an athlete, and every now and then I feel like we'd cross paths. He'd be like leaving the bar and I'd be going to like weights or, you know, whatever training we had that day. So yeah, I get hit by a car. I was fine. I was okay. I mean, I was off for a bit, but a month and a half later, I was like ready for playing Big Ten. And I was playing number one. I was captain. And I lost 5 matches in third set 10-point tie breaks. And I was like, fuck this shit.
5 in a row in 10-point tie breaks. That's a lot.
I'm not going to pretend that, like, I don't remember every single match I lost, what the score was. I remember it all. And it haunts me to this day. That's what made me good. I was so passionate. I try to tell people, like, I decided not to go on the pro tour, even though I saw a lot of my friends do it, not because I didn't think like I could do it, but more so that it was like my time to discover other sides of me. And what I tel people, I was speaking to Julia Albaba. She's an amazing collegiate athlete.
I love Julia.
Cause she was like dealing with some injuries and she found me online and she was like, I'm very lost. And I was like, whatever made you special on the tennis court, you're going to be special in other things you're doing. Like, even Perry, you right now doing this and having the confidence to like speak to anyone and put yourself out there, like, don't act like everything you've done in your tennis career hasn't helped you get to this point. And when first people would tell me that, I'd be like, well, I'm not fucking ranked in the WTA, so shut up. Where now people be like, how do you speak in front of, you know, 2,000 people? And I'm like, it's way more nerve-wracking second serve, 4-all, add out, and I'm the last one playing. Like, it's very easy for me to speak in front of people.
I totally feel that with the performative element of both of our jobs, but especially with you, stand-up comedy in front of all of these people. When you are preparing for stand-up comedy, is it similar to preparing for a match?
I definitely learned so much from performing with tennis. I still felt like I had a lot of mental battles that I wasn't able to overcome with tennis that haunted me for a while. Like, I would get the yips. I was in my head a lot. I was famously, like, a great practice player. And then during the match, it was like, who knows what Hannah's going to do?
Me too.
I was a winning ugly player, they'd call it. I'd be slicing forehands. I've underhand served. Coaches said that my report made no sense. Like, one day it was like, she's a power hitter. And next day they're like, she only lobs. The next day they were like, she double faults 100 times. The next day, like, who knew who was going to go down the court? But I was going to fight my life to win that match. Competition days weren't necessarily fun for me. Like, I feel like some girls hated practice and then they just love the competing. Like, I spoke to Coco Vandeweghe and she was like, all I want to do is compete. Where I was like, I want to be like practicing, training, getting better. And also some girls, I feel like they were so robotic. Like, you get on the court, you hit the winner. You get on the court, you have a pattern, you hit it. Where when I was on the court, I was thinking a bazillion things and I couldn't stop it. And I hate to say it, but those things that were hard for me with tennis make me the comedian I am today. Because I'm on stage, I know my jokes, I know what's going on to the right, I know what's going on to the left. I have a callback that I'm about to do later. I have a bazillion things going on in my head. I'm anxious, I'm depressed, and I'm going to speak on it because a lot of people relate to it. I was never as robotic as I needed to be, I think, with tennis. And I would do weird shit. I would hit drop shots for no reason. And my coach would be like, what was that? And I'm like, I felt like it.
I totally understand it. I relate so much to so much of what you're saying.
Okay.
One of my favorite artists, Maggie Rogers, says that an artist's job is to feel. And ever since I read that, I've become obsessed with that quote and really brought it into broadcasting. But what you've done is, I mean, you've made an empire out of feelings.
Perry, you're literally giving me chills right now because I was always like a little too passionate on the court. I loved being a college teammate because I'd rather focus on your match next to me and be like in the weeds with you. Like, let's go, girl. You got, like, I loved being the hype girl. And my own match, I'm like, I'm stressed. I'm stressed. And in doubles, I had this partner, Elena Turgovich. She was incredible. And her biggest weakness was she'd get pissed off and then she couldn't play as well. So my job was literally to keep her laughing. She'd miss a ball and I'd make a joke. I'd keep her light. Next thing you know, she'd play incredible. And I was just being like a mini professional comedian on the court. They're like, what are you saying to her? And I'm like, I don't fucking know. Whatever comes to my mind. I would get in trouble. I would giggle too much in practice. I remember once the trainer was like, if you giggle one more time, you have to do laps. And of course I laughed. And then I was like just running until my feet bled. So it wasn't always good, but I couldn't change who I was.
And you brought 100% of yourself to everything that you did. And I see that right now, even in these first 5 minutes talking to you, that you bring 100% of yourself to everything that you do. Did you always know that you were different as a player in that sense?
It was a lot of like, she's a mental case. She's a head case. She's crazy. When, first of all, tennis is the sport where you go crazy. You're alone talking to yourself. I would just like have full breakdowns all the time. I felt so much on the court. I also think I put a lot of my like normal life anxiety into the match. Like, if I could just win this match, everything is good. My relationships, my school. If I just win this match, no one could say shit to me. I put a lot of pressure on myself for sure.
That's what I had as an athlete, was really all that pressure on the result of the match. And I tried to become process oriented throughout college. And I think that's actually something that I learned. Did you have a moment where you felt like that shifted, or were you always feeling like results?
I was always very result oriented. I think I was 11 years old. I remember winning my first like level 2 or something and seeing the excitement in my dad's face and being like, this is what I want to do the rest of my life. When I would win, people treated me better. And I loved just beating the boys. I literally would get off on that. I played for the boys team in high school. But
I know, and the New York Times covered it.
Literally wild, crazy.
You were famous before you were famous, girl.
I do think wherever I go, I definitely give my all. And the greatest part of that story that people don't always know is that I had to play on the boys team because we didn't have funding for a girls team at the public school I was at, Beacon. And we won all these matches. People got upset there was a girl on the team. When I graduated to go to Wisconsin, they gave funding to the school to have a girls team, and my dad coached it. So it was kind of this beautiful full circle moment. And the girls team there, like, I always feel like so connected with. But yeah, when I started to do comedy, I was like, I'm going to approach this with all the things that I wish I approached tennis with. Because tennis had gotten too complicated already. I had too much pressure from parents, from coaches, finances, my own ego, the years of trauma and abuse, mentally and physically, of being an athlete that's top, top level. And I was like, first of all, I'm doing this for me. I'm doing it because I enjoy it. And when I go on stage, I know the self-talk I'm going to have because I don't win or lose. Every time something happens that might not be perfect, I'm like, wow, you became a better comedian. So I'm re-coaching and re-parenting myself through the career of comedy in the way that I wish I could have done it with tennis.
Girl, I'm already crying.
That was so beautifully said. And I think a lot of us in our next chapters after tennis echo that.
We're women in the arts. And the truth is, I was always a very creative player. And it's what made me good. Like, you'd never see the same shot from me. But like, it wasn't easy or fun to play. People would tell me, like, in the 14 unders, like, you can lose right now. But I didn't believe that. And it's still hard to believe it. If I went back, I probably wouldn't have believed it again. But I wish that I really was like focused on like hitting a really heavy ball. Focus on like patterns. Like focus on really getting the best second serve. Where instead it was just like, how do I win this match? And I really feel like I didn't. And the people around me didn't always like put in the right kind of practice. It was always like, I need to beat everyone in practice. Not let's get my serve better. Like, I don't know, maybe you had a better experience with that, but I feel like mine was always just, I need to win.
I did it while I was changing my forehand about 700 times to make it better, and it went back to the original forehand every time. So I would change it throughout the week, and then on the weekends, I would use my old forehand. So I made zero progress over about 10 years with this forehand.
Oh, girly pop, don't even get me started on the forehand.
Not the forehand,
don't
on her.
Even, I, don't get me started on the forehand. This is so dark. Okay, when I was 14 years old, I was ranked like top 15 in the nation. And I was like, she's going pro. So I went down to Florida, as one does. And they changed my grip. Because I had a Western grip. I feel like a lot of us did growing up.
This was my story.
And after like 2-3 months of this changed grip, I was like playing ITFs. So naturally, I never gained confidence in it. And I pretty much sliced my forehand in matches for the rest of my career. I played whole matches playing number one for University of Wisconsin, winning, slicing my forehand. It's embarrassing.
But it also shows that your competitive spirit is, it's elite.
Thanks for calling it a spirit.
No, I'm serious though, because people would say this to me that you almost just tie your hands behind your back when you're playing if you're going to slice every forehand. This is what people would say to me.
Did you slice your forehand?
I mean, I'm known on the team, ask anyone. It was, I sliced my forehand.
So we're best friends, kindred spirits, twin flames. Also, people slice backhands all the time and no one judges them.
And no one judges them.
I love a backhand down the line. Girl, my backhand down the line, my only shot.
Well, my backhand slice was actually fine. And it was just that once I started to slice forehands, things were not fine. We were not.
The problem is, yeah, returning a serve in doubles with a slice forehand is a nightmare. But what made me win, I think, was a lot of people didn't see my type of game. And I was very fast. I was good at net. Like, I was weird. I was a weird player, but it wasn't sustainable. I also, at the end of the day, I wasn't having fun. But it's very hard to understand when you're younger what fun is. Because the whole point of being a good athlete is not being in touch with your actual emotions. Are you nervous? No. Are you tired? No. Are you scared? No. I'm fucking numb. So how am I supposed to then stop and reflect if this is actually what I enjoy doing? And I was never one of those girls who was like, I hate tennis. I was like, I love this sport.
Me too.
It's all I know. It's all I want to do. Like, to this day, like, I have Wimbledon on right now. I love the sport so, so, so much. I think it's the most incredible, difficult sport in the world. But at 22, I never got all Big Ten. My name's not in the rafters. I'm lying in bed at an internship. I went from captain to an internship, getting people coffee for a like clothing brand in New York City, just being like, what the fuck was all that for if you're here now? And what's crazy is I once said to my mom, I was like, I want to do something with video. Because at the end of my Wisconsin tennis career, I did some sports broadcasting where I learned to edit. And I always kind of wanted to be a sports broadcaster because I love the camera. I don't shut up. And I love a lot of different sports. I come from a family of basketball coaches and everything is about sports. But I didn't want to start in a small market. I wanted to move back to New York City, which is where I live. I was like, Mom, I kind of want to like interview people on the subway. I like thought of that when I was 22. And then fast forward, I'm now 31 and I have almost like a billion views on interviewing people on the street thing. It's crazy. Like, my body knew what I wanted to do.
You followed that, though. That's the thing that puts all the pieces together as to why you are where you are. You wanted to do this, and then you did it. That's the thing about competitive tennis players, in my mind, is that we do set goals, and then we actually usually do them.
That is so true. And I do, like, work my butt off like a tennis player combined with my silly, goofy, creative side, which is really strong together. I really remember I got an interview for, like, someone who needs 5 years experience of a video producer at this, like, female comedy millennial company. And I was like, I don't have the experience, but these are all my ideas, and I'm a literal killer in the group chat. Like, I'm that girly. I will come up with the fun shit for you. And they were like, we'll give it a try. And then I felt like I was on my path. Like, I felt like I hit the right wave when you're surfing. And then it's suddenly smooth. You're not just getting hit in the face with the waves. But I had a lot of bad depression, identity crises, sadness after tennis because I did everything you were supposed to do and it didn't work out. But I realize now, like, I don't know if I actually wanted that life. Like, do we want to be in Tokyo right now, you know, alone? You lose every week unless you win it. Like, I don't know if I actually had the mental capacity for that. People right now are like, Hannah, I could never travel every weekend and perform comedy. And I'm like, no, that's what I meant to do.
It's a tough life as a professional tennis player. And I went through the same thing, this reckoning. And I was not at that level to be able to really decide if I wanted to go pro. The answer was no.
I mean, I was a little delusional, but continue.
No, you were top 15 in the country. I was never top 15 in the country.
You needed a little delusion to get there.
Well, we all do. I mean, as tennis players, to get where we even got, you have to be a little delusional. But it is living out of a suitcase. It's living out of hotel rooms. I mean, it's a lot of what you do when you're on tour. In a way, it's similar.
Comedy and tennis, what you're saying, is so similar. It's crazy. And I didn't realize it, but someone told me that a lot of comics are either athletes or addicts or both. I haven't suffered with addiction necessarily, but you could also argue that I was addicted to tennis. I mean, the highs of winning, like, where you're chasing it every single day. And, like, when you're in a lull, you're like, I just need that win. But I literally am traveling every weekend to perform. And I'm out there alone. It's very lonely, but it's, like, all I know. And I love the fact that when I was on the tennis court, I could do anything. I could be free out there, even if I was fucking up. I was still doing it my way. And that's how I feel with comedy. Like, I need to be, like, the lone wolf out here being creative and figuring stuff out, making my own mistakes is how, like, I thrive. So the pain, the trauma, the amazing moments, all of it from tennis has guided me here. And I'm at the point now where, like, I do love to hit. I do love to watch tennis. It is a huge part of who I am. And I'm so grateful for it. And I just kind of accepted, like, it wasn't your fault that you didn't go pro. You did what you could do.
What you said about doing everything right and it still didn't work out, that's completely how I felt for the last year and a half, 2 years. And now I'm in my third year and I finally feel like a little bit of peace with the whole thing because I do feel like I did my best and it just wasn't good enough.
Which is, for a tennis player to hear, is not okay. It sounds disappointing. But I always said it was like a breakup. And it was the longest relationship I've ever had. And they say breakups is like you divide the time you've been with that person by two, and that's how long it takes to get over it. So 2 years is, yeah, that is fresh, honey. You're fresh, 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 fresh. And it's normal to go through this kind of process and questioning. But I really do think the discipline I got from the sport was so, so special that, like, you don't even realize until, like, your career starts getting momentum and you're like, oh, people are playing checkers, I'm playing chess. Like, I've been through the weeds already. This is my second career. You've already had a whole career. That's immeasurable.
And we both went from a career where, of course, we were elite athletes physically, mentally, and emotionally to a career where we're in front of the camera and we're being judged by all of these people that aren't ourselves. How did you deal with those external judgments? And is there anything that other people or younger you would have done differently?
It kind of just comes with experience of getting tired. You cannot make everyone happy. And you can try in your 20s and you try your very best. But by your 30s, you're like, I don't give a fuck. This is me. If you like, you like. If you don't, you don't. I think what people don't talk about in your 20s is that you need to go through this to get tired. Do you know what I mean? Like, you get confidence by making all these mistakes in your 20s. Your 20s is for the breakups. It's for the wrong career paths. It's for questioning of identity. That is your 20s. And people try to make it like once you're 20, you're just a perfect adult and you know what's going on. And I think that we have to normalize that your 20s are a shit show and embrace it. Because I can't sit here and say, I know I love to do comedy without in my 20s doing cold calling sales, marketing, selling t-shirts, doing pop-up shops, having bad bosses, having good bosses. This is your time to wreck shit up.
I love that. And I think that that's a lot of what this podcast is about. I think in a lot of ways, the transition period, that gritty time of when things aren't pretty, I think it's just not talked about enough. But you've made it. When was the moment that you felt like, okay, my career is taking off? Was it by social media followers? Was it by the people that you would sell out at the tours? How did it work?
My thing is, because I've done stuff where I've been really miserable, like I'd say cold calling sales, I was actually like good at it and I was making good money, but I would just go in the bathroom and be like, what the fuck am I doing? Like, I hated asking people for things. And I remember thinking, I just want to wake up every day and have something I like to do. And I think as tennis players, we're spoiled because we got to play a game, even though it was really difficult and hard. At least I felt alive because we're used to the highs and lows. We are on some weird adrenaline kick with tennis. So then when you go from that to like a marketing job, you're like, am I existing? So my only goal was really to wake up and not be depressed, which sounds so sad. And people are like, how did you risk becoming a comedian? It's not a risk. There's no other option. I need to do what makes me happy. So honestly, once I started working for that first company, making funny videos, I felt like I made it. Like, I know I'm going to make money. I know I'm good at this and I'm going to figure it out. Like, that was the click for me. And in entertainment career, it's crazy. One day you get a TV deal. Next day you lose a TV deal. Like, there's so many ups and downs. But because of TikTok and social media, no one can fire me from that. I mean, granted, tomorrow Instagram can be shut down. TikTok is shut down. But I have this independence of my own career. Like, I know what I want, to be happy. And that requires not having a boss and being able to be creative. That's all I want. I'm riding the right wave right now. And it took me a while to find that after tennis. And I commend you for going into something creative. I know, like, especially Ivy League schools, it's like, go into finance, go and be a lawyer, like, whatever. You're going towards something that you naturally enjoy. And that's the hardest part, is just to find out what you enjoy, especially as an athlete, because you're like, I like to win. And they're like, no, no, no. What do you love? And you're like, winning.
How did you find confidence in yourself in those first few jobs? Because I do feel like in a lot of ways, as you were finding your path and finding what did make you happy, you must have had some hints along the way. Was it specific bosses, or was it more just the overall wanting to find something that just made you happier?
I do remember cold calling felt very similar to tennis. The guy was like, you're rejected all the time. Can you handle that? And I'm like, in a tennis match, I win 7-5, 6-4. I lost 44% of the points. Like, I can do this. And then I remember chasing the highs, like winning. And I'm like, I'm literally just doing tennis. Like, I just found the same shit. I want to delve deeper to like what I want, who I am. We have a lot of pressure, especially as women, to like be perfect at things and like not apply to jobs that we aren't overqualified for, where I feel like men will be like, I could do that. Let me prove it. So I had that mentality where I was like, I could do it. Let me prove it. Like, I did have a belief in myself. I started a podcast and I was just being myself. And I was going to do a live podcast show. Caroline's reached out, this club in New York City. My friend was like, I dare you to do 10 minutes of stand-up, because I was writing a lot of tweets at the time. I never wanted to be. That's another thing. Little Hannah always wanted to be a tennis player. I never thought about being a stand-up comedian. I would love watching comedy. Never thought it was for me. And I did 10 minutes of stand-up and people were like, that was my favorite part of the show. And it's also delusional, because you're not supposed to just do 10 minutes of stand-up. You're supposed to start with open mics in front of a 300-person crowd. I did my first 10 minutes of comedy. 10 minutes people could take years to get to. But like, don't play by the rules and believe in yourself.
And I've loved the outfits. I'm completely switching gears.
Oh my God, thank you.
I've loved the outfits that you wear on stage. Do you see fashion as kind of a way, for me at least, on air? There are two ways to see it, of course. One is that everybody's going to judge your body no matter what. But the second is, it's almost a way for me to find confidence in my own body again after tennis. Did you find that with your fashion choices?
It's funny, because there definitely was a time where didn't you feel weird wearing anything besides a tennis outfit?
Still, yes.
Yeah, like I'd put on a dress and I'm like, why do I look like a football player in a suit? I didn't even know how to like walk in heels. And even when I'd wear a dress, someone would always make a comment about my legs because I have like, it's genetic. Like I have very muscular looking legs. Like the girls would say the quads are quadding. They'd call me Quadzilla. I have huge calves. So I'd go on a date and the guy's like, you have really strong legs. And I'm like, thanks. Do you want to check my gums? Like, am I a horse? What's going on? So for me, comedy was always like, don't distract people. Don't show cleavage. You're not allowed to wear shorts or skirt. Like there were all these rules and you know how I feel about rules. So honestly, I think tennis had too many rules for me. Let's be honest.
Tennis has too many rules for everyone.
Right? I mean, like, why do I have to serve into that box? Anyway, so I was like, I also am talking to the girlies. Like, I'm not showing up to my friend's place dressed up, not cute. Like, I'm going to express myself. So I always feel like I'm going to brunch date to talk shit. I'm going to wear something fun. And it's funny because I wasn't aware of it, but other female comics were like, dude, I love your outfits on stage. And I'm like, am I being a weirdo? Like, what? What do you mean outfits? But I realized that's for old school comedy clubs when just like a bunch of dudes watching someone on stage. Comedy has changed and comedy's for everyone. And the guys like my outfits too. And I do every now and then think of Serena where she was like, look good, play good. Do you remember she said that?
Of course, 100%. And I mean, all of the iconic times that people have tried to tell Serena that her outfit is quote unquote not okay or not allowed. And as you said, too many rules in tennis. Tennis is one of the only sports where you can literally get condemned for an outfit. And here we are at Wimbledon, where of course Wimbledon just allowed for the first time women to wear slightly off color pants under their shorts because of course we all get our period.
Wait, I didn't know that. I mean, that's amazing. And I love to see it. I love it evolving. I did once get my period at an all-white event, which thank you for bringing up. I'm re-traumatized by.
Sorry.
I do think the fashion is something that, again, you make it you. And I don't have the traditional body type of like some of my friends. Every now and then I joke because people will be like, you're so body positivity. I'm like, what? Is that a compliment? Or you know, I'm like, you don't call my friend who's a model body positive when she wears a bikini. But I do think it's more like I have meat, like I have muscles and my body has been a vessel capable to do so many things. Even if it's like I have a volleyball game later, I'm gonna fucking be speedy on there because I have a body that is capable of being athletic. I'm just out here trying to be authentic with myself, and if someone takes 1% of it to feel less weird about their own stuff, then I'm good. Life is okay. Now we're getting full circle. Life was never about winning, even though that's what we thought growing up. And I think that's what I had to work on. Like being successful does not equate to being lovable. I've always played games in my head and created my own goals that I push myself because we don't have coaches anymore. But like I'm choosing every day what I want to do and how hard I want to push myself. And there's balance and learning about, you know, self-care. It's a new thing. It is you finding what makes you tick and deciding what you actually enjoy. Because let's be honest, there were some parts of tennis that we didn't. And now we can take the good parts into like our new journey.
And leaving the bad parts behind. And that's something I've struggled with a little bit, is just leaving that overdrive part behind. Because in a lot of ways, that's what helps us get to where we are. But then it also is what, for me, drives me right over the edge because I have so many goals and so little time and then also so little sleep.
Yes. I do think as a tennis player, we all are perfectionists. And that's our biggest weakness. If you're a perfectionist on the court too, like I know like Iga Świątek is and Djokovic is, but they're fucking miserable when they're in like crazy perfection mode. You know, when you're in the zone and you're just like moving, you're grooving, you're not looking at every single place your hand is on the ball. I know from a young age, you know, when you win, people treat you well. So in my head, I'm like, when I'm successful, people love me. And then there's been points like I've lost jobs. I've gotten fired from a lot of shit before. And I've been sitting there being like, why would anyone want to be with me? Why are my parents, they're not proud of me? And then realizing like, no, that stuff is up and down. You need to find out what's special to you and what makes you you. And what makes me me, it's not the winning and losing, is that you can't break me. I know that whatever the universe throws at me, it's how you react to it. We're all going to have horrible things happen to us. It's literally like tennis. Let's say I just called your ball out. You can freak out and tank the next three games, or you can decide, I'm not even going to make this a thing. I don't care. I'm on to the next point. What makes you great is not what you're accomplishing. It's how you cope with your situations, how I deal with adversity, and how I've overcome from like the lows of having to build myself up from nothing after like not going pro is strength. Like imagine something happens with journalism or broadcasting, you get fired from a job. You fucking lost tennis. You're going to be fine. You're going to figure it out. This pain is power.
I'd like to frame that. Could I keep that forever?
Yes.
Thank you.
Not to be like, I'm an elder, but after 31 and looking at all the ups and downs, it's like, oh, you know what I'm good at? I'm not the funniest. I'm not the smartest. I'm not even the hardest working, but I bounce back. Like, you can't get rid of me, bitch.
I literally love that. And also, you are so unbelievably funny. I'm serious about this. How is the evolution of being funny? And did you have a moment where you felt like the switch went off, that you were funny and it brought you confidence and joy?
You know what it was? Before I'd go on the tennis court, I would always be in the bathroom with a upset stomach, nervous pee, nervous other things. I would literally be sick. And I would be like quiet because I would be so in my head like 2 hours before the match. Like, who is this girl in the car? Because I was so fucking nervous. And I remember before I went on to perform for the first time with stand up, I was like, am I gonna freeze? Am I gonna do what I do with tennis? And then they called me up. I went on stage and I felt like I was talking to my friends. And I was like, oh, maybe that's what like Serena Williams feels like when she plays tennis. So honestly, like I knew things that trigger me in a negative way. And once I realized that comedy, like I could just make people laugh. And I'm not saying tennis was wrong for me because I really was athletic and good at the game. It was just I found something else that brought me joy, and you don't have to be one dimensional. Like my husband loves tennis. And like when he found out I was a tennis player, he loved it. And it really bonds us. Like it's part of who I am. It doesn't leave you. The more you are away from it, I think actually the more proud of yourself you are. It's just when you're really close to it, you're like, oh, I used to wake up and play 3 hours and like be chasing a dream. I was going to be a champion. And your brain evolves, but you're going through a really serious breakup right now. And it happens to everyone when they retire, when they get injured, when they graduate. But people don't talk about it enough, and that's why I really love what you're doing with this pod. And like as a tennis player, I don't know if people have said this to you, but it's like people want to hire tennis players. We are so mentally strong. Even though I just said I was insane for the whole episode, at the end of the day, I'm really strong. I never quit. Even if I was serving underhand, I showed up. And I think that's like huge.
Yeah, that's half the battle. I mean, 50% of our jobs is... for you is walking on stage, and for me, it's showing up to the studio. And I so admire what you've done and what you're doing to show women that we can move on from competitive sports and be something even greater. Because yes. Hannah, you were such a fantastic tennis player, but now you're a world famous comedian. I mean, look at your career and what you've done, and it really grounds me because at the end of the day, it's not the end for us. We do have another chapter.
I actually remember I was in high school and someone was saying, like, it was like an art teacher. And they were like, you know, the football players are actually really good at like sculpture. And I was like, what? And they were like, yeah, some of the athletes are like super creative. And I think there's a lot of stuff that we suppressed when we were playing because we had to. And now it's like time to explore all those things. And I think you asked about this earlier in terms of like, I feel like I'm in the tennis mindset still. Use that, but it's like you decide how to keep score. Like how I keep score is being like, did I get on stage? Did I try that new joke? It's not, did it work? Did I try it? Because that's the hardest part. Didn't go well. You became a better comic because you dealt with a joke not going well and you still recovered. So it's like you set your own rules now. My biggest piece of advice is that on the court, I had a lot of negative self-talk. Once I realized that I could have positive self-talk, it was like a cheat code to life. I'm like, you don't have to shit on yourself when you do bad. You could be nice to yourself. Once I realized I could be my biggest supporter and biggest cheerleader, it was like a weight got lifted off me. Because coaches, there's so much just negativity they throw at you. And the second you're like, actually, I don't need that. And you know how you wish you were spoken to. And I think that's how you start speaking to yourself at this job.
You're truly unbelievable. Where can people find tickets and where are you going next?
Yeah, so hannahburner.com/shows. I have San Francisco, Chicago, Atlanta, Milwaukee. I haven't done Rhode Island yet. I'm going to be in Maine. I might do Virginia. I don't know. We're like packing it out with a lot of shows in the fall and the winter. But yeah, just keep an eye out because I love my Northeast girlies.
Well, I know that you usually have supermodels at your shows. No. You might not be able to see me because I'm not that tall, but my hair is red, so look for that.
And your outfit will be fire.
I will probably have Jordans on, so you can look at my feet.
My name is Hannah Berner, and I'm on the rise.
And this is your host, Perry Shine, and this has been another episode of On the Rise podcast. This has been an episode of On the Rise, a Tennis Channel podcast in partnership with Behind the Racket. It's produced by Molly Getman and Lyric Bowditch. Join us next time to continue our conversation about women's college tennis. This is Perry Shinen, On the Rise.